It was a few minutes before the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. I stood at the window of my room, looking up Northumberland Avenue towards Trafalgar Square, waiting for Big Ben to tell that the war was over. My mind strayed back across the scarring years to the scene and emotions of the night at the Admiralty, when I listened for these same chimes in order to give the signal of war against Germany to our fleets and squadrons across the world. And now all was over. The unarmed and untrained island nation, who with no defense but its navy had faced unquestioningly the strongest manifestation of military power in human record, had completed its task. Our country had emerged from the ordeal alive and safe, its vast possessions intact, its war effort still waxing, its institutions unshaken, its people and empire united as never before. The minutes passed. I was conscious of reaction rather than elation. The material purposes on which one's work had been centered, every process of thought on which one had lived, crumbled into nothing. The whole vast business of supply, the ever-growing output, the careful boards, the secret future plans, but yesterday the whole duty of life, all at a stroke, vanished like a nightmare dream, leaving a void behind. My mind mechanically persisted in exploring the problems of demobilization. What were to happen to our 3 million munition workers? What would they make now? How would the roaring factories be converted? How, in fact, are swords beaten into plowshares? How long would it take to bring the armies home? What would they do when they got home? We had, of course, a demobilization plan for the Ministry of Munitions. It had been carefully worked out, but it had played no part in our thoughts. Now it must be put into operation. The levers must be pulled, full steam astern. The Munitions Council must meet without delay. And then suddenly the first stroke of the chime. I looked again at the broad street beneath me. It was deserted. From the portals of one of the large hotels, absorbed by government departments, darted the slight figure of a girl clerk, distractedly gesticulating, while another stroke resounded. Then from all sides, men and women came scurrying into the street. Streams of people poured out of all the buildings. The bells of London began to clash. Northumberland Avenue was now crowded with people in hundreds, nay thousands, rushing hither and thither in a frantic manner, shouting and screaming with joy. I could see that Trafalgar Square was already swarming. Around me, in our very headquarters, in the Hotel Metropole, disorder had broken out. Doors banged, feet clattered down corridors. Everyone rose from the desk and cast aside pen and paper. All bound for a broken, the tumult grew. It grew like a gale, but from all sides simultaneously. The street was now a seething mass of humanity. Flags appeared as if by magic. Streams of men and women flowed from the embankment. They mingled with torrents pouring down the Strand on their way to acclaim the king. Almost before the last stroke of the clock had died away, the strict, war-straitened, regulated streets of London had become a triumphant pandemonium. At any rate, it was clear that no more work would be done that day. The curtain falls upon the long front in France and Flanders. The soothing hands of time and nature, the swift repair of peaceful industry, have already almost effaced the crater fields and the battle lines, which in a broad belt from the Vosges to the sea lately blackened the smiling fields of France. The ruins are rebuilt. The riven trees are replaced by new plantations. Only the cemeteries, the monuments, and stunted steeples, with here and there a mouldering trench or huge mine crater lake assail the traveler with the fact that 25 millions of soldiers fought here and 12 millions shed their blood or perished in the greatest of all human contentions less than 20 years ago. Merciful oblivion draws his veils. The crippled limp away, the mourners fall back into the sad twilight of memory. New youth is here to claim its rights, and the perennial stream flows forward, even in the battle zone, as if the tale were all a dream. Is this the end? Is it to be merely a chapter in a cruel and senseless story? Will a new generation in their turn be immolated to square the black accounts of Teuton and Gaul? Will our children bleed and gasp again in devastated lands? Or will there spring from the very fires of conflict that reconciliation of the three giant combatants, which would unite their genius and secure to each in safety and freedom a share in rebuilding the glory of Europe?
Winston Churchill, his reflections upon the hour of armistice, 11 a.m., the 11th of November, 1918. And now, from his memoirs of the Second World War, Winston Churchill reads Chapter 1, 1919 to 1929, The Follies of the Victors.
After the end of the World War of 1914, there was a deep conviction and almost universal hope that peace would reign in the world. This heart's desire of all the peoples could easily have been gained by steadfastness in righteous convictions and by reasonable common sense and prudence. The phrase, the war to end war, was on every lip, and measures had been taken to turn it into reality. President Wilson, wielding, as was thought, the authority of the United States, had made the conception of a League of Nations dominant in all minds. The British delegation at Versailles molded and shaped his ideas into an instrument which will forever constitute a milestone in the hard march of man. The victorious armies were at that time all-powerful, so far as their outside enemies were concerned. They had to face grave internal difficulties and many riddles to which they did not know the answer. But the Teutonic powers in the great mass of Central Europe, which had made the upheaval, were prostrate before them, and Russia, already shattered by the German flail, was convulsed by civil war and falling into the grip of the Bolshevik or Communist Party. In the summer of 1919, the Allied armies stood along the Rhine, and their bridgeheads bulged deeply into defeated, disarmed, and hungry Germany. The chiefs of the victor powers debated and disputed the future in Paris. Before them lay the map of Europe, to be redrawn almost as they might resolve. Germany, the head and forefront of the offense, regarded by all as the prime cause of the catastrophe which had fallen upon the world, was at the mercy or discretion of conquerors, themselves reeling from the torment they had endured. The war leaders assembled in Paris had been borne thither upon the strongest and most furious tides that have ever flowed in human history. Gone were the days of the treaties of Utrecht and Vienna, when aristocratic statesmen and diplomats, victor and vanquished alike, met in polite and courtly disputation, and free from the clatter and babel of democracy, could reshape systems upon the fundamentals of which they were all agreed. The peoples, transported by their sufferings and by the mass teachings with which they had been inspired, stood around in scores of millions to demand that retribution should be exacted to the full. Woe betide the leaders now perched on their dizzy pinnacles of triumph if they cast away at the conference table what soldiers had won on 100 blood-soaked battlefields. France, by right alike of her efforts and her losses, held the leading place. Nearly 1.5 million Frenchmen had perished defending the soil of France on which they stood against the invader. 5 times in 100 years, in 1814, 1815, 1870, 1914, and 1918, had the towers of Notre Dame seen the flash of Prussian guns and heard the thunder of their cannonade. Now, for four horrible years, 13 provinces of France had lain in the rigorous grip of Prussian military rule. Wide regions had been systematically devastated by the enemy or pulverized in the encounter of the armies. To those Frenchmen, and there were many in high authority, who had fought and suffered in 1870, it seemed almost a miracle that France should have emerged victorious from the incomparably more terrible struggle which had just ended. The Kaiser's mailed fist and shining armor speeches might be received as ridicule in England and America. It sounded a knell of horrible reality to the hearts of the French. For 50 years almost they had lived under the terror of the German arms. Now at the price of their lifeblood, the long oppression had been rolled away. Surely here at last was peace and safety. With one passionate spasm, the French people cried, never again. What prospect was there in the future that the great allies would once again appear in their millions upon the battlefields of France or in the East? Russia was in ruin and convulsion, transformed beyond all semblance of the past. Italy might be upon the opposite side. Great Britain and the United States were separated by the seas or oceans from Europe. The British Empire itself seemed knit together by ties which none but its citizens could understand. When again would peaceful, careless, anti-militarist Britain tramp the plains of Artois and Picardy with armies of 2 or 3 million men? When again would the ocean bear 2 millions of the splendid manhood of America to Champagne and the Argonne? Worn down, doubly decimated, but undisputed masters of the hour, the French nation peered into the future in thankful wonder and haunting dread. Where then was that security, without which all that had been gained seemed valueless, and life itself, even amid the rejoicings of victory, was almost unendurable? The mortal need was security, at all costs, and by all methods, however stern or even harsh. On Armistice Day, the German armies had marched homeward in good order. They fought well, said Marshal Foch, Generalissimo of the Allies, with the laurels bright upon his brow. Speaking in soldierly mood, let them keep their weapons. But he demanded that the French frontier should henceforth be the Rhine. Germany might be disarmed, her military system shivered in fragments, her fortresses dismantled. Germany might be impoverished. She might be loaded with measureless indemnities. She might become a prey to internal feuds. But all this would pass in 10 years or in 20. The indestructible might of all the German tribes would rise once more, and the unquenched fires of warrior Prussia glow and burn again. But the Rhine, the deep, broad, swift-flowing Rhine, once held and fortified by the French army, would be a barrier and a shield behind which France could dwell and breathe for generations. Very different were the sentiments and views of the English-speaking world, without whose aid France must have succumbed. The territorial provisions of the Treaty of Versailles left Germany practically intact. She still remained the largest homogeneous racial bloc in Europe. When Marshal Foch heard of the signing of the peace treaty of Versailles, he observed with singular accuracy, "This is not peace, it is an armistice for 20 years. The economic clauses of the treaty were malignant and silly to an extent which made them obviously futile. Germany was condemned to pay reparations on a fabulous scale. These dictates gave expression to the anger of the victors and to the failure of their peoples to understand that no defeated nation or community can ever pay tribute on a scale which would meet the cost of modern war. The multitudes remained plunged in ignorance of the simplest economic facts, and their leaders, seeking their votes, did not dare to undeceive them. The newspapers, after their fashion, reflected and emphasized the prevailing opinions. Few voices were raised to explain that payment of reparations can only be made by services or by the physical transportation of goods in wagons across land frontiers or in ships across salt water. Or that when these goods arrive in the demanding countries, they dislocate the local industry, except in very primitive or rigorously controlled societies. In practice, as even the Russians have now learned, the only way of pillaging a defeated nation is to cart away any movables which are wanted, and to drive off a portion of its manhood as permanent or temporary slaves. But the profit gained from such processes bears no relation to the cost of the war. Not one in great authority had the wit, ascendancy, or detachment from public folly to declare these fundamental, brutal facts to the electorate, nor would anyone have been believed if he had. The triumphant Allies continued to assert that they would squeeze Germany till all the pips squeaked. All this had a potent bearing on the prosperity of the world and the mood of the German race. In fact, however, these clauses were never enforced. On the contrary, whereas about 1,000 millions of German assets were appropriated by the victorious powers, more than 500 millions were lent a few years later to Germany, principally by the United States and Great Britain, thus enabling the ruin of the war to be rapidly repaired in Germany. As this apparently magnanimous process was still accompanied by the machine-made howlings of the unhappy and embittered populations in the victorious countries, and the assurances of their statesmen that Germany should be made to pay to the uttermost farthing, no gratitude or goodwill was to be expected or reaped. Germany only paid, or was only able to pay, the indemnities later extorted because the United States was profusely lending money to Europe, and especially to her. In fact, during the 3 years, 1926 to 1929, the United States was receiving back, in the form of debt installments, indemnities, from all quarters, about one-fifth of the money which she was lending to Germany with no chance of repayment. However, everybody seemed pleased and appeared to think that this might go on forever. History will characterize all these transactions as insane. They helped to breed both the Marshall Curse and the economic blizzard, of which more later. Germany now borrowed in all directions, swallowing greedily every credit which was lavishly offered her. Thus, Germany gained the 2,000 million sterling in loans, as against the 1,000 millions of indemnities which she had paid in one form or another by surrender of capital assets and valuta to foreign countries, or by juggling with the enormous American loans. All this is a sad story of complicated idiocy, in the making of which much toil and virtue were consumed. The victors imposed upon the Germans all the long-sought ideals of the liberal nations of the West. They were relieved from the burden of compulsory military service and from the need of keeping up heavy armaments. A democratic constitution, in accordance with all the latest improvements, was established at Weimar. Emperors having been driven out, known entities were elected. Beneath this flimsy fabric raged the passions of the mighty, defeated, but substantially uninjured German nation. The prejudice of the Americans against monarchy, which Mr. Lloyd George made no attempt to counteract, had made it clear to the beaten empire that it would have better treatment from the Allies as a republic than as a monarchy. Instead, a gaping void was opened in the national life of the German people. All the strong elements, military and feudal, which might have rallied to a constitutional monarchy and for its sake respected and sustained the new democratic and parliamentary processes, were for the time being unhinged. The void was open, and into that void, after a pause, there strode a maniac of ferocious genius, the repository and expression of the most virulent hatreds that have ever corroded the human breast, Corporal Hitler. It was Niagara, France, that greeted the dawn of victory. Deep fear of Germany pervaded the French nation on the morrow of their dazzling success. It was this fear that had prompted Marshal Foch to demand the Rhine frontier for the safety of France against her far larger neighbor. But the British and American statesmen held that the absorption of German-populated districts in French territory was contrary to the 14 points and to the principles of nationalism and self-determination upon which the peace treaty was to be based. They therefore withstood Foch and France. They gained Clemenceau by promising first a joint Anglo-American guarantee for the defense of France, secondly, a demilitarized zone, and thirdly, the total, lasting disarmament of Germany. The treaty of guarantee was signed accordingly by Wilson and Lloyd George and Clemenceau. The United States Senate refused to ratify the treaty. They repudiated President Wilson's signature. And we, who had deferred so much to his opinions and wishes in all this business of peacemaking, were told without much ceremony that we ought to be better informed about the American Constitution. In the fear, anger, and disarray of the French people, the rugged, dominating feature of Clemenceau, with his world-famed authority and his special British and American contacts, was incontinently discarded. Ingratitude towards their great men, says Plutarch, is the mark of strong peoples. It was imprudent for France to indulge this trait when she was so grievously weakened. The British temper towards Germany, which at first had been so fierce, very soon went as far astray in the opposite direction. The two nations fell apart in thought and action, and British sympathy or even admiration for Germany found powerful expression. The League of Nations had no sooner been created than it received an almost mortal blow. The United States abandoned President Wilson's offspring. The president himself, ready to do battle for his ideals, suffered a paralytic stroke just as he was setting forth on his campaign, and lingered henceforward a futile wreck for a great part of two long and vital years, at the end of which his party and his policy were swept away by the Republican presidential victory of 1920. Europe must be left to stew in its own juice and must pay its lawful debts. At the same time, tariffs were raised to prevent the entry of the goods by which alone these debts could be discharged. At the Washington Conference of 1921, far-reaching proposals for naval disarmament were made by the United States, and the British and American governments proceeded to sink their battleships and break up their military establishments with gusto. It was argued in odd logic that it would be immoral to disarm the vanquished unless the victors also stripped themselves of their weapons. The finger of Anglo-American reprobation was presently to be pointed at France, deprived alike of the Rhine frontier and of our treaty guarantee, for maintaining even on a greatly reduced scale a French army based on universal service. And the United States made it clear to Britain that the continuance of her alliance with Japan, to which the Japanese had punctiliously conformed, would constitute a barrier in Anglo-American relations. Accordingly, this alliance was brought to an end.
The annulment caused a profound impression in Japan and was viewed as the spurning of an Asiatic power by the Western world. Many links were sundered which might afterwards have proved of decisive value to peace. Thus, both in Europe and in Asia, conditions were swiftly created by the victorious Allies, which in the name of peace cleared the way for the renewal of war. While all these untoward events were taking place, amid a ceaseless chatter of well-meant platitudes on both sides of the Atlantic, a new and more terrible cause of quarrel than the imperialism of czars and kaisers became apparent in Europe. The civil war in Russia ended in the absolute victory of the Bolshevik Revolution. Although Marshal Foch wisely observed that Bolshevism had never crossed the frontiers of victory, the foundations of European civilization trembled in the early post-war years. Fascism was the shadow or ugly child of communism. And while Corporal Hitler was making himself useful to the German officer class in Munich by arousing soldiers and workers to fierce hatred of Jews and communists, on whom he laid the blame of Germany's defeat, another adventurer, Benito Mussolini, provided Italy with a new theme of government, which, while it claimed to save the Italian people from communism, raised himself to dictatorial power. Nevertheless, one solid security for peace remained. Germany was disarmed. All her artillery and weapons were destroyed. Her fleet had already sunk itself in Scapa Flow. Her vast army was disbanded. By the Treaty of Versailles, only a professional long service army, not exceeding 100,000 men, and unable on this basis to accumulate reserves, was permitted to Germany for the purposes of internal order. No military air force of any kind was allowed. Submarines were forbidden, and the German Navy was limited to a handful of vessels under 10,000 tons. The French army, resting upon its laurels, was incomparably the strongest military force in Europe, and it was for years believed that the French Air Force was also of a high order. Up till the year 1934, the power of the conquerors remained unchallenged in Europe, and indeed throughout the world. There was no moment in these 16 years when the three former allies, or even Britain and France, with their associates in Europe, could not, in the name of the League of Nations and under its moral and international shield, have controlled by a mere effort of the will the armed strength of Germany. Instead, until 1931, the victors, and particularly the United States, concentrated their efforts upon extorting by vexatious foreign controls their annual reparations from Germany. The fact that these payments were only made from far larger American loans reduced the whole process to the absurd. Nothing was reaped except ill will. On the other hand, the strict enforcement at any time till 1934 of the disarmament clauses of the peace treaty would have guarded indefinitely, without violence or bloodshed, the peace and safety of mankind. But this was neglected, while the infringements remained petty and shunned as they assumed serious proportions. Thus, the final safeguard of a long peace was cast away. The crimes of the vanquished find their background and their explanation, though not, of course, their pardon, in the follies of the victors. Without these follies, crime would have found neither temptation nor opportunity. I attempt to recount some of the incidents and impressions which form in my mind the story of the coming upon mankind of the worst tragedy in its tumultuous history. When the storm and dust of the cannonade passed suddenly away, the nations, despite their enmities, could still recognize each other as historic racial personalities. the laws of war had on the whole been respected. There was a common professional meeting ground between military and men who had fought one another. Vanquished and victors alike still preserved the semblance of civilized states. A solemn peace was made, which apart from unenforceable financial aspects, conformed to the principles which in the 19th century had increasingly regulated the relations of enlightened peoples. In the Second World War, every bond between man and man was to perish. Crimes were committed by the Germans under the Hitlerite domination to which they allowed themselves to be subjected, the wholesale massacre by systematized processes of 6 or 7 million of men, women, and children. In the German execution camps, the hideous process of bombarding open cities from the air, once started by the Germans, was repaid 20-fold by the ever-mounting power of the Allies and found its culmination in the use of the atomic bomb, which obliterated Hiroshima and Nagasaki. After all that we suffered and achieved, we find ourselves still confronted with problems and perils, not less but far more formidable than those to which we have so narrowly made our way. It is my purpose, as one who lived and acted in these days, to show how easily the tragedy of the Second World War could have been prevented, how the malice of the wicked was reinforced by the weakness of the virtuous, how the structure and habits of democratic states, unless they are welded into larger organisms, lack those elements of persistence and conviction which can alone give security to humble masses, how even in matters of self-preservation, no policy is pursued for even 10 or 15 years at a time. We shall see how the counsels of prudence and restraint may become the prime agents of mortal danger, how the middle course adopted from desires for safety and a quiet life may be found to lead direct to the bull's eye of disaster. We shall see how absolute is the need of a broad path of international action pursued by many states in common across the years, irrespective of the ebb and flow of national politics. When 3 or 4 powerful governments acting together have demanded the most fearful sacrifices from their peoples, when these have been given freely for the common cause, and when the longed-for result has been attained, it would seem reasonable that concerted action should be preserved so that at least the essentials would not be cast away. But this modest requirement, the might, civilization, learning, knowledge, science of the victors, were unable to supply. They lived from hand to mouth and from day to day and went from one election to another until when scarcely 20 years were out, the dread signal of the Second World War was given. And we must write of the sons of those who had fought and died so faithfully and well. Shoulder to aching shoulder, side by side, they trudged away from life's broad wheels of light.
Chapter 3, Second World War, Lurking Dangers.
In my book, The Aftermath, I have set down the impressions of the 4 years which elapsed between the armistice and the change of government in Britain at the end of 1922. Writing in 1928, I was deeply under the impression of a future catastrophe. I wrote, "It was not until the dawn of the 20th century of the Christian era that war began to enter into its kingdom as the potential destroyer of the human race. All the noblest virtues of individuals were gathered together to strengthen the destructive capacity of the mass. Democratic institutions gave expression to the willpower of millions. Education not only brought the course of the conflict within the comprehension of everyone, but rendered each person serviceable in a high degree for the purpose in hand. The press afforded a means of unification and of mutual stimulation. Religion, having discreetly avoided conflict on the fundamental issues, offered its encouragements and constellations through all its forms, impartially to all the combatants. Lastly, science unfolded her treasures and her secrets to the desperate demands of men, and placed in their hands agencies and apparatus almost decisive in their character. In consequence, many novel features presented themselves. Instead of fortified towns being starved, whole nations were methodically subjected, or sought to be subjected, to the process of reduction by famine. The entire population, in one capacity or another, took part in the war. All were equally the object of attack. The air opened paths along which death and terror could be carried far behind the lines of the actual armies, to women, children, the aged, the sick, who in earlier struggles would perforce have been left untouched. Marvelous organization of railroads, steamships, and motor vehicles placed and maintained tens of millions of men continuously in action. Healing and surgery, in their exquisite developments, returned them again and again to the shambles. Nothing was wasted that could contribute to the process of waste. The last dying kick was brought into military utility. But all that happened in the 4 years of the Great War was only a prelude to what was preparing for the fifth year. The campaign of the year 1919 would have witnessed an immense accession to the powers of destruction. Had the Germans retained the morale to make good their retreat to the Rhine, thousands of airplanes would have shattered their cities, scores of thousands of cannon would have blasted their front. Arrangements were being made to carry simultaneously 250,000 men, together with all their requirements, continuously forward across country in mechanical vehicles moving 10 or 15 miles each day. Poison gases of incredible malignity, against which only a secret mask, which the Germans could not obtain in time, was proof. These would have stifled all resistance and paralyzed all life on the hostile front subjected to attack. No doubt the Germans, too, had their plans. But the hour of wrath had passed. The signal of relief was given, and the horrors of 1919 remained buried in the archives of the great antagonists. The war stopped as suddenly and as universally as it had begun. The world lifted its head, surveyed the scene of ruin, and victors and vanquished alike drew breath. In 100 laboratories, in 1,000 arsenals, factories and bureaus, men pulled themselves up with a jerk and turned from the task in which they had been absorbed. Their projects were put aside, unfinished, unexecuted. But their knowledge was preserved. Their data, calculations, and discoveries were hastily bundled together and docketed for future reference by the war offices in every country. The campaign of 1919 was never fought, but its ideas go marching along. In every army they are being explored, elaborated, refined under the surface of peace. And should war come again to the world, it is not with the weapons and agencies prepared for 1919 that it will be fought, but with developments and extensions of these which will be incomparably more formidable and fatal. It is in these circumstances that we entered upon that period of exhaustion which has been described as peace. It gives us at any rate an opportunity to consider the general situation. Certain somber facts emerge, solid, inexorable, like the shapes of mountains from drifting mist. It is established that henceforward whole populations will take part in war, all doing their utmost, all subjected to the fury of the enemy. It is established that nations who believe their life is at stake will not be restrained from using any means to secure their existence. It is probable, nay certain, that among the means which will next time be at their disposal will be agencies and processes of destruction, wholesale, unlimited, and perhaps, once launched, uncontrollable. Mankind has never been in this position before, without having improved appreciably in virtue or enjoying wiser guidance. It has got into its hands, for the first time, the tool by which it can unfailingly accomplish its own extermination. That is the point in human destinies to which all the glories and toils of men have at last led them. They would do well to pause and ponder upon their new responsibilities. Death stands at attention, obedient, expectant, ready to serve, ready to shear away the peoples en masse, ready, if called on, to pulverize without hope of repair what is left of civilization. He awaits only the word of command. He awaits it from a frail, bewildered being, long his victim, now, for one occasion only, his master. All this was published on January 1, 1929. Now, on another New Year's Day, 18 years later, I could not write it differently. All the words and actions for which I am accountable between the wars had as their object only the prevention of a Second World War, and of course of making sure that if the worst happened, we won, or at least survived. There can hardly ever have been a war more easy to prevent than this second Armageddon. I've always been ready to use force in order to defy tyranny or ward off ruin. But had our British, American, and Allied affairs been conducted with the ordinary consistency and common sense usual in decent households, there was no need for force to march unaccompanied by law. And strength, moreover, could have been used in righteous causes with little risk of bloodshed. In their loss of purpose, in their abandonment even of the themes they most sincerely espoused, Britain, France, and most of all, because of their immense power and impartiality, the United States, allowed conditions to be gradually built up, which led to the very climax they dreaded most. They have only to repeat the same well-meaning, short-sighted behavior towards the new problems which in singular resemblance confront us today to bring about a third convulsion from which none may live to tell the tale. I'd written even earlier, in 1925, some thoughts and queries of a technical character which it would be wrong to omit in these days. May there not be methods of using explosive energy incomparably more intense than anything heretofore discovered? Might not a bomb no bigger than an orange be found to possess a secret power to destroy a whole block of buildings, nay, to concentrate the force of 1,000 tons of cordite and blast the township at a stroke? Could not explosives, even of the existing type, be guided automatically in flying machines by wireless or other rays without a human pilot in ceaseless procession upon a hostile city, arsenal, camp, or dockyard? As for poison gas and chemical warfare in all its forms, only the first chapter has been written of a terrible book. Certainly every one of these new avenues to destruction is being studied on both sides of the Rhine with all the science and patience of which man is capable. And why should it be supposed that these resources will be limited to inorganic chemistry? A study of disease, of pestilence, is methodically prepared and deliberately launched upon man and beast, is certainly being pursued in the laboratories of more than one great country. Blight to destroy crops, anthrax to slay horses and cattle, plague to poison not armies only, but whole districts. Such are the lines on which military science is remorselessly advancing. All this is nearly a quarter of a century old. It is natural that a proud people, vanquished in war, should strive to rearm themselves as soon as possible. The responsibility, therefore, of enforcing a continual state of military disarmament upon a beaten foe rests upon the victors. For this purpose, they must pursue a twofold policy. First, while remaining sufficiently armed themselves, they must enforce with tireless vigilance and authority the clauses of the treaty which forbid the revival of their late antagonists' military power. Secondly, they should do all that is possible to reconcile the defeated nation to its lot by acts of benevolence designed to procure the greatest amount of prosperity in the beaten country, and labor by every means to create a basis of true friendship and of common interests, so that the incentive to appeal again to arms will be continually diminished. In these years, I coined the maxim, the redress of the grievances of the vanquished should precede the disarmament of the victors. As will be seen, the reverse process was to a large extent followed by Britain, the United States, and France.
Chapter 4, Second World War, Adolf Hitler.
In October 1918, a German corporal had been temporarily blinded by chlorine gas in a British attack near Comines. While he lay in hospital in Pomerania, defeat and revolution swept over Germany. The son of an obscure Austrian customs official, he had nursed youthful dreams of becoming a great artist. Having failed to gain entry to the Academy of Art in Vienna, he had lived in poverty in that capital and later in Munich, sometimes as a house painter, often as a casual laborer. He suffered physical privations and bred a harsh, though concealed, resentment that the world had denied him success. These misfortunes did not lead him into communist ranks. By an honorable inversion, he cherished all the more an abnormal sense of racial loyalty and a fervent and mystic admiration for Germany and the German people. He sprang eagerly to arms at the outbreak of the war and served for 4 years with a Bavarian regiment on the Western Front. Such were the early fortunes of Adolf Hitler. As he lay sightless and helpless in hospital during the winter of 1918, his own personal failure seemed merged in the disaster of the whole German people. The shock of defeat, the collapse of law and order, the triumph of the French, caused this convalescent regimental orderly an agony which consumed his being and generated those portentous and measureless forces of the spirit which may spell the rescue or the doom of mankind. The downfall of Germany seemed to him inextricable by ordinary processes. Somewhere there had been a gigantic and monstrous betrayal. Lonely and pent within himself, the little soldier pondered and speculated upon the possible causes of the catastrophe, guided only by his narrow personal experiences. He had mingled in Vienna with extreme German nationalist groups, and here he had heard stories of sinister, undermining activities of another race, foes and exploiters of the Nordic world, the Jews. His patriotic anger fused with his envy of the rich and successful into one overpowering hate. When at length, as an unnoted patient, he was released from hospital, still wearing the uniform, in which he had an almost schoolboyish pride, what scenes met his newly unscaled eyes? Fearful are the convulsions of defeat. Around him in the atmosphere of despair and frenzy glared the lineaments of Red Revolution. Armored cars dashed through the streets of Munich, scattering leaflets or bullets upon the fugitive wayfarers. His own comrades, with defiant red armbands on their uniform, were shouting slogans of fury against all that he cared for on earth. As in a dream, everything suddenly became clear. Germany had been stabbed in the back and clawed down by the Jews, by the profiteers and intriguers behind the front, by the accursed Bolsheviks in their international conspiracy of Jewish intellectuals. Shining before him, he saw his duty to save Germany from these plagues, to avenge her wrongs, and lead the master race to their long-decreed destiny. The officers of his regiment, deeply alarmed by the seditious and revolutionary temper of their men, were very glad to find one, at any rate, who seemed to have the root of the matter in him. Corporal Hitler desired to remain mobilized and found employment as a political education officer or agent. In this guise, he gathered information about mutinous and subversive designs. Presently, he was told by the security officer for whom he worked to attend meetings of the local political parties of all complexions. One evening in September 1919, the corporal went to a rally of the German Workers' Party in a Munich brewery, and here he heard for the first time people talking in the style of his secret convictions against the Jews, the speculators, the November criminals who had brought Germany into the abyss. On September 16, he joined this party, and shortly afterwards, in harmony with his military work, undertook its propaganda. In February 1920, the first mass meeting of the German Workers' Party was held in Munich. And here Adolf Hitler himself dominated the proceedings. and in 25 points outlined the party program. He had now become a politician. His campaign of national salvation had been opened. In April, he was demobilized, and the expansion of the party absorbed his whole life. By the middle of the following year, he had ousted the original leaders, and by his passion and genius forced him and the hypnotized company the acceptance of his personal control. Already he was the Führer. An unsuccessful newspaper, the Völkische Beobachter, was bought as the party organ. The communists were not long in recognizing their foe. They tried to break up Hitler's meetings, and in the closing days of 1921, he organized his first units of stormtroopers. Up to this point, all had moved in local circles in Bavaria. But in the tribulation of German life during these first post-war years, many began here and there throughout the Reich to listen to the new gospel. The fierce anger of all Germany at the French occupation of the Ruhr in 1923 brought what was now called the National Socialist Party a broad wave of adherents. The collapse of the Mark destroyed the basis of the German middle class, of whom many in their despair became recruits of the new party and found relief from their misery in hatred, vengeance, and patriotic fervor. At the beginning, Hitler had made it clear that the path to power lay through aggression and violence against a Weimar Republic born from the shame of defeat. By November 1923, the Führer had a determined group around him, among whom Göring, Hess, Rosenberg, and Röhm were prominent. These men of action decided that the moment had come to attempt the seizure of authority in the state of Bavaria. General von Ludendorff lent the military prestige of his name to the venture, and marched forward in the putsch. It used to be said before the war, in Germany there will be no revolution, because in Germany all revolutions are strictly forbidden. This precept was revived on this occasion by the local authorities in Munich. The police troops fired, carefully avoiding the general, who marched straight forward into their ranks and was received with respect. About 20 of the demonstrators were killed. Hitler threw himself upon the ground, and presently escaped with other leaders from the scene. In April 1924, he was sentenced to 4 years imprisonment. Although the German authorities had maintained order, and the German court had inflicted punishment, the feeling was widespread throughout the land that they were striking at their own flesh and blood, and were playing the foreigner game at the expense of Germany's most faithful sons. Hitler's sentence was reduced from 4 years to 13 months. These months in the Landsberg fortress were, however, sufficient to enable him to complete, in outline, Mein Kampf, a treatise on his political philosophy inscribed to the dead of the recent putsch. When eventually he came to power, there was no book which deserved more careful study from the rulers, political and military, of the Allied powers. All was there, the program of German resurrection, the technique of party propaganda, the plan for combating Marxism, the concept of a national socialist state, the rightful position of Germany at the summit of the world. Here was the new Quran of faith and war, turgid, verbose, shapeless, but pregnant with its message. The main thesis of Mein Kampf is simple. Man is a fighting animal. Therefore, the nation, being a community of fighters, is a fighting unit. Any living organism which ceases to fight for its existence is doomed to extinction. A country or a race which ceases to fight is equally doomed. The fighting capacity of a race depends on its purity. Hence the need for ridding it of foreign defilements. The Jewish race, owing to its universality, is of necessity pacifist and internationalist. Pacifism is the deadliest sin, for it means the surrender of the race in the fight for existence. The first duty of every country is, therefore, to nationalize the masses. Intelligence, in the case of the individual, is not of first importance. Will and determination are prime qualities. The individual who is born to command is more valuable than countless thousands of subordinate natures. Only brute force can ensure the survival of the race. Hence the necessity for military forms. The race must fight, A race that rests must rust and perish. Had the German race been united in good time, it would have been already master of the globe. The new Reich must gather within its fold all the scattered German elements in Europe. A race which has suffered defeat can be rescued by restoring its self-confidence. Above all things, the army must be taught to believe in its own invincibility. To restore the German nation, the people must be convinced that the recovery of freedom by force of arms is possible. The aristocratic principle is fundamentally sound. Intellectualism is undesirable. The ultimate aim of education is to produce a German who can be converted with the minimum of training into a soldier. The greatest upheavals in history would have been unthinkable had it not been for the driving force of fanatical and hysterical passions. Nothing could have been effected by the bourgeois virtue to peace and order. The world is now moving towards such an upheaval, and the new German state must see to it that the race is ready for the last and greatest decisions on this earth. Foreign policy may be unscrupulous. It is not the task of diplomacy to allow a nation to founder heroically, but rather to see that it can prosper and survive. England and Italy are the only two possible allies for Germany. No country will enter into an alliance with a cowardly, pacifist state run by Democrats and Marxists. So long as Germany does not fend for herself, nobody will fend for her. Her lost promises cannot be regained by solemn appeals to heaven or by pious hopes in the League of Nations, but only by force of arms. Germany must not repeat the mistake of fighting all her enemies at once. She must single out the most dangerous and attack him with all her forces. The world will only cease to be anti-German when Germany recovers equality of rights and resumes her place in the sun. There must be no sentimentality about Germany's foreign policy. To attack France for purely sentimental reasons would be foolish. What Germany needs is increase of territory in Europe. Germany's pre-war colonial policy was a mistake and should be abandoned. Germany must look for expansion to Russia, and especially to the Baltic states. No alliance with Russia can be tolerated. To wage war together with Russia against the West would be criminal, for the aim of the Soviets is the triumph of international Judaism. Such were the granite pillars of his policy.
Chapter 5, Second World War, The Locust Years, 1931 to 1935.
The British government, which resulted from the general election of 1931, was in appearance one of the strongest, and in fact one of the weakest, in British records. Mr. Ramsay MacDonald, the Prime Minister, had severed himself with the utmost bitterness on both sides from the Socialist Party, which it had been his life's work to create. Henceforward, he brooded supinely at the head of an administration which, though nominally national, was in fact overwhelmingly conservative. Mr. Baldwin preferred the substance to the form of power and reigned placidly in the background. During the period of almost 5 years of this administration, from January 1931 to November 1935, the entire situation on the continent of Europe was reversed. All Germany was astir, and great events marched forward.
The 24th of April, 1933. The Royal Society of St. George Dinner, London. The speaker, Winston Churchill, gives his contemporary version of the legend of St. George and the Dragon.
And I am going to speak to you about St. George and the Dragon. I've been wondering what would have happened to him and to his story if he'd lived nowadays. If his achievements had to be repeated in a modern sense. Well, I suppose it would have been something like this. St. George would have arrived in Cappadocia, accompanied not by a war horse, but by a highly competent secretary. He would be armed not with a lance, but with some flexible formula. He would, of course, be welcomed enthusiastically by the local branch of the League of Nations Union. fortified by their encouragement, he would propose a conference with the dragon. It would be a round table conference, no doubt. That's so much more convenient for the dragon's tail. He would then proceed to make a trade agreement with the dragon. He would certainly lend the dragon a lot of money. Raised from the highly tried Cappadocian taxpayer. Well, so much for St. George and the Dragon.
We return to Chapter 5, the Second World War, the Locust Years.
On the 21st of March, 1933, Hitler opened in the garrison church at Potsdam the first Reichstag of the Third Reich. In the body of the church sat the representatives of the Reichswehr, the symbol of the continuity of German might. On March 24, the majority of the Reichstag, overbearing and overawing all opponents, confirmed by 441 votes to 94 complete emergency powers to Chancellor Hitler for 4 years. As the result was announced, Hitler turned to the benches of the socialists and cried, "And now I have no further need of you." It is not within my scope to describe the inconceivable brutality and villainy by which this apparatus of hatred and tyranny had been fashioned and was now to be perfected. It is necessary for the purposes of this account only to present the new and fearful fact which had broken upon the still unwitting world: Germany under Hitler and Germany arming. While these deadly changes were taking place in Germany, the MacDonald-Baldwin government felt bound to enforce for some time the severe reductions and restrictions which the financial crisis had imposed upon our already modest armaments, and steadfastly closed their eyes and ears to the disquieting symptoms in Europe. In vehement efforts to procure a disarmament of the victors equal to that which had been enforced upon the vanquished by the Treaty of Versailles, Mr. MacDonald and his conservative and liberal colleagues pressed a series of proposals forward in the League of Nations and through every other channel that was open. When in May 1932 the virtues of disarmament were extolled in the House of Commons by all parties, the Foreign Secretary opened a new line in the classification of weapons which should be allowed or discouraged. He called this qualitative disarmament. It was easier to expose the fallacy than to convince the members. I said, the Foreign Secretary told us that it was difficult to divide weapons into offensive and defensive categories. It certainly is, because almost every conceivable weapon may be used in defense or offense, either by an aggressor or by the innocent victim of his assault. To make it more difficult for the invader, heavy guns, tanks, and poison gas are to be relegated to the evil category of offensive weapons. The invasion of France by Germany in 1914 reached its climax without the employment of any of these weapons. The heavy gun is to be described as an offensive weapon. It is all right in a fortress. There it is virtuous and pacific in its character. But bring it out into the field, and of course if it were needed, it would be brought out into the field, and it immediately becomes naughty, peccant, militaristic, and has to be placed under the ban of civilization. Take the tank.
the tank was invented to overcome the fire of the machine guns with which the Germans were maintaining themselves in France. And it saved a lot of lives in clearing the soil of the invader. Now, apparently, the machine gun, which was a German weapon for holding on to 13 provinces of France, is to be the virtuous defensive machine gun, and the tank, which was the means by which the Allied lives were saved, is to be placed under the censure and obloquy of all just and righteous men. A truer classification might be drawn in banning weapons which tend to be indiscriminate in their action and whose use entails death and wounds, not merely on the combatants in the fighting zones, but on the civil population, men, women, and children, far removed from those areas. There, indeed, it seemed to me, would be a direction in which the United Nations assembled at Geneva might advance with hope. At the end of this speech, I gave my first formal warning of approaching war. I should very much regret to see any approximation in military strength between Germany and France. Those who speak of that as though it were right, or even a question of fair dealing, altogether underrate the gravity of the European situation. I would say to those who would like to see Germany and France on an equal footing in armaments, do you wish for war? For my part, I earnestly hope that no such approximation will take place during my lifetime or that of my children. To say that is not in the least to imply any want of regard or admiration for the great qualities of the German people. But I am sure that the thesis that they should be placed in an equal military position with France is one which, if ever it emerged in fact, would bring us within practical distance of an almost measureless calamity. The British air estimates from March 1933 revealed a total lack of comprehension, alike by the government and the opposition, of what was going on. I had to say on March 14, regretted to hear the Undersecretary say that we were only the fifth air power and that the 10-year program was suspended for another year. I was sorry to hear him boast that the Air Ministry had not laid down a single new unit this year. All these ideas are being increasingly stultified by the march of events, and we should be well advised to concentrate upon our air defenses with greater vigor. Under the so-called national government, British public opinion showed an increasing inclination to cast aside all care about Germany. In vain the French had pointed out correctly in a memorandum of July 21, 1931, that the general assurance given at Versailles that a universal limitation of armaments should follow the one-sided disarmament of Germany did not constitute a treaty obligation. It certainly was not an obligation enforceable apart from time and circumstance. Yet when in 1932 the German delegation to the disarmament conference categorically demanded the removal of all restrictions upon their right to rearm, they found much support in the British press. The Times spoke of the timely redress of inequality, and the New Statesman of the unqualified recognition of the principle of the equality of states. This meant that the 70 million Germans ought to be allowed to rearm and prepare for war without the victors in the late fearful struggle being entitled to make any objection. The German government were emboldened by the British demeanor. In July, their delegation gathered up its papers and quitted the disarmament conference. To coax them back then became the prime political object of the victorious Allies. In November, the French, under severe and constant British pressure, proposed what was somewhat unfairly called the Aerial Plan. The essence of this was the reconstruction of all European defense forces as short service armies with limited numbers, admitting equality of status, but not necessarily accepting equality of strength. In fact and in principle, the admission of equality of status made it impossible, ultimately, not to accept equality of strength. This enabled the Allied government to offer to Germany equality of rights in a system which would provide security for all nations. Under certain safeguards of an illusory character, the French were reduced to accepting this meaningless formula. On this, the Germans consented to return to the disarmament conference. This was hailed as a notable victory for peace. Fanned by the breeze of popularity, His Majesty's government now produced, on March 16, 1933, what was called, after its author and inspirer, the MacDonald Plan. It accepted as its starting point the adoption of the French conception of short-service armies, in this case of 8 months' service, and proceeded to prescribe exact figures for the troops of each country. By this time, the German military forces, although not yet provided with the mass of trained reserves, which only a succession of annual conscripted quotas could supply, may well have amounted to the equivalent of over 1 million armed volunteers, partially equipped, and with many forms of the latest weapons coming along through the convertible and partially converted factories to arm them. At the end of the First World War, France, like Great Britain, had an enormous mass of heavy artillery, whereas the cannon of the German army had in fact been blown to bits, according to treaty. Mr. MacDonald sought to remedy this evident inequality by proposing to limit the calibre of mobile artillery guns to 105 millimetres, or 4.2 inches. Existing guns up to 6 inches could be retained, but all replacements were to be limited to 4.2 inches. British interests, as distinct from those of France, were to be protected by the maintenance of the treaty restrictions against German naval armaments till 1935, when it was proposed that a new naval conference should meet. Military aircraft were prohibited to Germany for the duration of the agreement, that the three Allied powers should reduce their own air forces to 500 planes apiece. I viewed this attack upon the French armed forces and the attempt to establish equality between Germany and France with strong aversion, and on the 23rd of March, 1933, I had the opportunity of saying to Parliament, "I doubt the wisdom of pressing this plan upon France at the present time. I do not think the French will agree. They must be greatly concerned at what is taking place in Germany, as well as at the attitude of some others of their neighbors. I dare say that during this anxious month, there are a good many people who have said to themselves, as I have been saying for several years, thank God for the French army. When we read about Germany, when we watch with surprise and distress the tumultuous insurgence of ferocity and war spirit, the pitiless ill treatment of minorities, the denial of the normal protections of civilized society, the persecution of large numbers of individuals solely on the ground of race, when we see all that occurring in one of the most gifted, learned, and scientific and formidable nations in the world, one cannot help feeling glad that the fierce passions that are raging in Germany have not yet found any other outlet but upon themselves. It seems to me that at a moment like this, to ask France to halve her army while Germany doubles hers, to ask France to halve her air force while the German air force remains whatever it is a proposal likely to be considered by the French government, at present at any rate, as somewhat unreasonable. I spoke again in April. The Germans demand equality in weapons and equality in the organization of fleets and armies. And we have been told you cannot keep so great a nation in an inferior position. What others have, they must have. I have never agreed. It is a most dangerous demand to make. Nothing in life is eternal, but as surely as Germany acquires full military equality with her neighbors, while her own grievances are still unredressed, and while she is in the temper which we have unhappily seen, so surely should we see ourselves within a measurable distance of the renewal of general European war. One of the things which we were told after the Great War would be a security for us was that Germany would be a democracy with parliamentary institutions. All that has been swept away. You have most grim dictatorship. You have militarism and appeals to every form of fighting spirit, from the reintroduction of drilling in the colleges to the Minister of Education advising the plentiful use of the cane in the elementary schools. You have these martial or pugnacious manifestations, and also this persecution of the Jews, of which so many members have spoken. I will leave Germany and turn to France. France is not only the sole great surviving democracy in Europe, she is also the strongest military power, I am glad to say, and she is the head of a system of states and nations. France is the guarantor and protector of the whole crescent of small states which runs right round from Belgium to Yugoslavia and Romania. They all look to France. When any step is taken by England or any other power to weaken the diplomatic or military security of France, all these small nations tremble with fear and anger. They fear that the central protective force will be weakened, and that then they will be at the mercy of the great Teutonic power. When one considers that the facts were hardly in dispute, the actions of a responsible government of respectable men and the public opinion which so flocculently supported them are scarcely comprehensible. It was like being smothered by a feather bed. I remember particularly the look of pain and aversion which I saw on the faces of members in all parts of the House when I said, "Thank God for the French army." Words were vain. However, the French had the hardihood to insist that there should be a delay of 4 years before the destruction of their heavy war material. The British government accepted this modification, provided that the French agreement about the destruction of their artillery was specified in a document for immediate signature. France bowed to this, and on October the 12th, 1933, Sir John Simon, after complaining that Germany had shifted her ground in the course of the preceding weeks, brought these draft proposals before the disarmament conference. The result was unexpected. Hitler, now Chancellor and master of all Germany, having already given orders on assuming power to drive ahead boldly on a nationwide scale, both in the training camps and the factories, felt himself in a strong position. He did not even trouble to accept the quixotic offers pressed upon him. With a gesture of disdain, he directed the German government to withdraw both from the conference and from the League of Nations. Such was the fate of the MacDonald Plan. It is difficult to find a parallel to the unwisdom of the British and weakness of the French governments. Nor can the United States escape the censure of history, absorbed in their own affairs, and all the abounding interests, they simply gaped at the vast changes which were taking place in Europe and imagined that they were no concern of theirs. The considerable core of highly competent, widely trained professional American officers formed their own opinions, but these produced no notable effect upon the improvident aloofness of American foreign policy. If the influence of the United States had been exerted, it might have galvanized French and British politicians into action. The League of Nations, battered though it had been, was still an august instrument which would have invested any challenge to the new Hitler war menace with the sanctions of international law. Under the strain, the Americans merely shrugged their shoulders, so that in a few years they had to pour out the blood and treasures of the new world to save themselves from mortal danger. In this dark time, the basest sentiments received acceptance or passed unchallenged by the responsible leaders of the political parties. In 1933, the students of the Oxford Union, under the inspiration of a Mr. Joad, passed their ever-shameful resolution that this House refused to fight for king and country. It was easy to laugh off such an episode in England, but in Germany, in Russia, in Italy, in Japan, the idea of a decadent, degenerate Britain took deep root and swayed many calculations. Little did the foolish boys who passed the resolution dream that they were destined quite soon to conquer or fall gloriously in the ensuing war,
and prove themselves the finest generation ever bred in Britain. Less excuse can be found for their elders, who had no chance of self-redemption in action. In November 1933, we had another debate in the House of Commons. I returned to my main theme. We read of large importations of scrap iron and nickel and war metals into Germany, quite out of the ordinary. We read all the news which accumulates of the military spirit which is rife throughout the country. We see that a philosophy of bloodlust is being inculcated into their youth, to which no parallel can be found since the days of barbarism. We see all these forces on the move, and we must remember that it is the same mighty Germany which fought all the world and almost beat the world. It is the same mighty Germany which took 2.5 lives for every German life that was taken. This, of course, excluded the Russian losses. No wonder when you have these preparations, these doctrines, and these assertions openly made, that there is alarm throughout the whole circle of nations which surround Germany.
Chapter 7, 1934 to 1935, Air Parity Lost.
The German General Staff did not believe that the German army could be formed and matured on a scale greater than that of France and suitably provided with arsenals and equipment before 1943. But owing to the unlucky discovery by an immature civilization of the internal combustion engine and the art of flying, a new weapon of national rivalry had leapt upon the scene, capable of altering much more rapidly the relative war power of states. As in the case of the German army, the recreation of the German air power was long and carefully prepared in secret. In November came the Reichstag election, at which no candidates, except those endorsed by Hitler, were tolerated, and the Nazis obtained 95% of the vote polled. It would be wrong in judging the policy of the British government not to remember the passionate desire for peace which animated the uninformed, misinformed majority of the British people and seemed to threaten with political extinction any party or politician who dared to take any other line. This, of course, is no excuse for political leaders who fall short of their duty. It's much better for parties or politicians to be turned out of office than to imperil the life of the nation. Moreover, there is no record in our history of any government asking Parliament and the people for the necessary measures of defence and being refused. The air estimates of March 1934 totaled only 20 millions and contained provision for 4 new squadrons, or an increase in our first-line air strength from 850 to 890. On this I say, Germany is arming fast, and no one is going to stop her. That seems quite clear. No one proposes a preventive war to stop Germany breaking the Treaty of Versailles. She is going to arm. She is doing it. She has been doing it. I have no knowledge of the details, but it is well known that those very gifted people, with their science and with their factories, with what they call their air sport, are capable of developing with great rapidity the most powerful air force for all purposes, offensive and defensive, within a very short period of time. I dread the day when the means of threatening the heart of the British Empire should pass into the hands of the present rulers of Germany. We should be in a position which would be odious to every man who values freedom of action and independence, and also in a position of the utmost peril for our crowded, peaceful population engaged in their daily toil. I dread that day, but it is not perhaps far distant. It is perhaps only a year, or perhaps 18 months distant. It has not come yet, at least so I believe, or I hope and pray. But it is not far distant. There is time for us to take the necessary measures, but it is the measures we want. We want the measures to achieve parity. No nation playing the part we play and aspire to play in the world has a right to be in the position where it can be blackmailed. None of the grievances between the victors and the vanquished have been redressed. The spirit of aggressive nationalism was never more rife in Europe and in the world. Far away are the days of Locarno, when we nourished bright hopes of the reunion of the European family. I call upon Mr. Baldwin as the man who possessed the power for action. His was the power and his the responsibility. In the course of his reply, Mr. Baldwin said, if all our efforts for an agreement fail, and if it is not possible to obtain this equality in such matters as I have indicated, then any government of this country, a national government more than any, and this government, will see to it that in our strength and our power, this country shall no longer be in a position inferior to any country within striking distance of its shores. Here was a most solemn and definite pledge given at a time when it could almost certainly have been made good by vigorous action on a large scale.